Brethren, I'm not sure if you got out to sample the day today, but it's much nicer than yesterday. But we are expecting some wind. Brother Allen's title this morning is The Four Winds. The Four Winds, Brother Allen. Thank you.
There are some things we're sure about, and there's some things we're not sure about. And there's different opinions on prophetic matters, and I think it's understandable because some things are in the process of fulfillment, some things are in the future, so I'm not set in stone on the following thoughts. I desire to stay close to the harvest message and the writings of Brother Russell, but I know lots of other brethren who would say the same thing, and some who would come to different conclusions than I would. So I respect that. So take that for what it's worth. The following is my perspective, what I've tried to glean from the harvest message on this subject. And if you think differently, well, it's a great opportunity for us to renew our studies on the subject and to look at these things more carefully. And maybe you won't change your mind. That's okay. But if all you do is go back and study it again, then it will have accomplished its purpose. If there was one word that I would want to use, it would be process. And some of those of you who have talked to me about this before, these subjects, then you're probably tired of hearing that word. But I think it's an important one. I think that there are many places in the plan of God where we see a process, a beginning, a period of time during which something is developed, and then a climax. And there is a tendency for us to maybe focus on one aspect rather than another. Some look only at the beginning, and, well, that's all that's important. Some look only at the end, and that's all that's important. And some maybe put too much emphasis on the process. Well, obviously, we want to have all of the big picture and put all the pieces together in order to get the proper perspective. So, here's what we're going to talk about. I believe that from beginning to end in the harvest message, the same concept is presented concerning the subject, that the time of trouble is a process that has different phases. That the time of trouble will involve spasms of trouble, each growing more severe. The last spasm will be anarchy, and the last spasm will correspond with the loosing of the four winds. Now, I would just add one word there, the full loosing of the four winds. Because I believe the loosing of the four winds is also a process. And that's where maybe it will engender some further discussion, I'm sure. But let's look at what some pictures we have are in the scriptures. One of them is Elijah's vision. And that's in 1 Kings 19, 11, and 12. You're familiar with it. The four phases of the time of trouble presented there. Begins with wind, then goes to earthquake, fire, then the still small voice. I believe that that represents war, which begins and continues in spasms, earthquake, social revolution, which begins at a certain point and continues in spasms, fires of anarchy, which begin at a certain point and continue with spasms. And at the end, you got it all blowing together, so to speak. And finally, that still small voice of the peaceable kingdom. Regarding the fires of anarchy, I believe that it corresponds to the loosing of the four winds. And we would find scriptures to support this in Zephaniah 3:8, 2 Peter 3, 6, 7, and 10 to 13. And the still small voice which follows the fire in Zephaniah 3:9. I firmly believe that all the prophetic and historic indicators show that this time of trouble began in 1914. Now, concerning phases or spasms of trouble, there are many places where we find this in the harvest message, and so we'll cite a few references for you and the scriptural support that goes along with that. And we're going to go through them in chronological order, so you can see that this was the thought that Brother Russell had at the beginning, and he retained this thought through to the end. 1886, Volume 1, Study 15, page 307, The Day of Jehovah is the name of that period of time in which God's kingdom under Christ is to be gradually set up in the earth while the kingdoms of this earth or world are passing away, and Satan's power and influence over men are being bound. Now, maybe I would put too much emphasis on certain words here, but it shows to me process. For instance, God's kingdom is gradually being set up. That, to me, is a process. The kingdoms of this world are passing away. Again, a process. Satan's power and influence is being bound during this period. I also see that as a process. And I believe that scriptural support for this process we can find in 2 Peter 3:10, Hebrews 12:26 to 29, Psalm 46 in entirety, and a number of other places. Again, volume 1, page 312 to 313 in that area there, the concept being that the character of the trouble will be a class struggle between the wealthy and laboring classes requiring a long period of time. Well, all we have to do is look at the past 100 years, and I think we see that. And that's, of course, really the ultimate proof for whether we believe something is correct or not. Do we see it? Page 334. Quote, a series of convulsions more frequent and severe as the day draws on until the final one, 1 Thessalonians 5, 2, and 3, end of quotation. So here you see this process, and he ties it in to that scripture about the birth pangs, that 1 Thessalonians 5 is talking about the last one. But any of you sisters who have ever given birth to a child, you know there's not just one. There's a whole bunch that come before that, right? If there's anybody that only had one birth pang, I'd like to know that. Volume 4, written in 1897, 11 years later, page 284. Each succeeding spasm will probably be more severe until the final one. Same concept. Also from page 548, volume 4, that's study 11. Spasms or throes of trouble with shortening intervals between each future spasm will be more severe. 1901, a reprint, 2875, reprint 2875, 1901. Quote, the culmination of the trouble in October 1914 is clearly marked in the scriptures, and we are bound, therefore, to expect a beginning of that severe trouble not later than 1910, with severe spasms between now and then. Now, you know, we have to, of course, understand from the later writings that 1910, he was expecting something to happen because of indications in the Great Pyramid. 1914, he thought it would be all over. At the time he wrote this, that was his thinking. Later, he corrected the dates, but he didn't change the concept. And it's the concept that we want to look at here, that he expected that there would be a period of time during which the time of trouble would have these various spasms leading up to the climax. From 1908, reprint 4109, and particularly on reprint 4110 of that article, Travailing in Birth of a New Era, the final spasm, which we look for in 1915, will give birth to the new dispensation. Well, notice a subtle shift here. And he gradually adjusted his thinking because he was a realistic and intelligent man. And he saw that things were happening, and there wasn't enough time for everything to be accomplished by 1914. So he extended it by a year, but still showing that there would be spasms of trouble. Now, the length of time that would be required for that process was corrected later, and we'll look at those momentarily. 1911, this is a very important article in its entirety, and we would highly recommend the brethren to read it. Reprint 4822, reprint 4822, entitled The Loosing the Four Winds of Heaven. And there is a section in there devoted to Revelation 7, 1 to 3, and it begins, an old scripture, a new importance. An old scripture, a new importance. So he's looking at a lot of prophecies as the time is going on, as they're getting closer to 1914, and he's rethinking all this. So he says, well, what about Revelation 7, 1 to 3? And notice he's very careful. He doesn't change the basic concepts. And in fact, the only thing he does here is he makes one adjustment and he adds something. The things that didn't change: earth represents organized society. The sea represents the disorganized masses. The trees represent the household of faith. Winds can represent strife or false doctrine, Ephesians 4:14. And a whirlwind represents the great time of trouble or anarchy. Now, if you've studied it carefully, perhaps you've noticed the same distinction that I have, that there's a difference between the time of trouble and the great time of trouble. The time of trouble is the entire period involving all four of those phases of wind, earthquake, fire, still small voice, whereas the great time of trouble really is focusing more on the climax, the seventh plague and various other aspects, which is tied more to the anarchy. He makes a slight modification in this article, saying that the completion of the church would perhaps be between the period 1914 or 1915, that the completion of the church would occur in the final birth pang or spasm, that climax would be sudden, like it was with the Elisha picture, but the idea of a process did not change. The time frame for the beginning and ending of that process changed. He knew that this was necessary as 1914 grew closer, but he also began to have doubts as to whether there was enough time for that process to be completed even by 1915. But he also changed some things prophetically. He expressed concern or caution as to how the completion of the church would be fulfilled and when. He knew it had to be after 1914, but he wasn't sure exactly when. This is in 1911. There is, however, a key point that he adds. He adds the thought concerning the four winds, which he introduces in this article, and he carries forward throughout all references to it that I was able to find subsequently. And that is that the four winds represent the fallen angels. Now, we need to make a distinction between the angels that are holding the four winds, the result of the loosing of the four winds. Those are three different things. But the four winds themselves, he shows the idea here that it is the fallen angels. And this is something we want to focus on. Not only because it's interesting prophetic, but because it has relevance to us in our consecrated walk. He doesn't give any specific time frame in this article for some of these aspects. We find those later on and elsewhere. Now, to go back to the time of trouble like travail upon a woman, we want to look at some additional references regarding this. And as we already mentioned, we believe that this is consistently portrayed in the Harvest Message. Volume 2, page 21, he says, "Not sudden as lightning, but sudden as travail upon a woman." In reprint 4285, which is 1908, we are to anticipate further financial spasms as travail upon a woman with child, with increasing severity until the climax shall be reached. Same concept, but it's interesting, he focuses a great deal on financial problems. I find that interesting. He had a great deal of foresight, and that he understood that the financial problems would play a great role in the time of trouble as it progressed. Now let's move on to 1914, and this is from reprint 5448, Views from the Watchtower, under section We Fulfill Our Promise. A few quotations from this. This is a transitional article, again, as they were getting closer to October 1914. And he's looking at what's happening and what he was expecting to happen. And he's making adjustments. "We had expected that if the Gentile time should end with the present year, this would surely mean that all the bride class would participate in the first resurrection change from earthly conditions to heavenly conditions before the end of the present year. Although this was not stated positively, it was pointed out to be the logical conclusion. Now it does not look so." So here he's getting more precise and saying church isn't going to be completed in 1914 by October. Another quote. "The scriptures most distinctly tell us that the catastrophe will come suddenly as travail upon a woman with child." Now we have to understand that when he says sudden, as he said before, not sudden like lightning, but he makes this point that it says travail upon a woman, which is a process of spasms of trouble, each one growing more severe. Another quote, "It is not impossible, It is not impossible that all of our expectations may be realized before the end of this year. We consider, however, that this is highly improbable. Final quote. There is still a possibility that we have made no mistake in respect to the time, but have erred in respect to the things expected. For instance, it may be that the Gentile times do expire with the present year, but that the Lord will not dispossess them nor take them from their earthly dominion so quickly as we had anticipated. Considering that they've been in power for 2,520 years, dispossession in 1 year might seem very sudden. Indeed, to accomplish it in 5 or 10 or 20 years might not seem an unreasonable time. End of that quotation. Well, this is rather important, the points that are being made here. He's saying what we expected regarding the completion of the church and the time of trouble. There's no way this is going to be over in 1914. But there's still a way that those Gentile times could end. And what do we have to do? We have to include a process once that period has ended until their turning over is complete. Now, there are many suggestions and cautions that were given prior to 1914, but this perhaps is one of the strongest up to that point, May of 1914. And he opened the idea, which again he carries forward in subsequent articles, that there would be a gradual process of dispossession beginning in October 1914 and covering many years, possibly decades, for its completion. You know, to me, this is interesting that he begins to introduce the idea that there might be a long period of time after 1914. He mentions 20 years, but I think he's just using that as an example. He doesn't state specifically how long he thought it would be. Okay, now we get to a real sensitive area, perhaps. And I know there's a lot of different thoughts on this one, and it has to do with the ceiling and the forehead. I'd like to believe that there's a way to harmonize all of this, and I'm sure there is. But there's two real long question book articles covering this subject, both from 1914, and I think they're very important in understanding the subject of the ceiling and the forehead. The first one begins on page 79, question book 79, goes through to question book 89. And the second one begins on 89 and goes to 99. And we'll be looking at some key points from those two. That's a lot of pages, 21 pages altogether. So we'll try to summarize. And it's your responsibility to go back through and check it and see if I'm doing it correctly or not. And let me know. I'm sure you will. The times of the Gentiles ending in 1914 is a scriptural expectation. And he gives some points. Zedekiah was the last king of Israel of the order of David. In 2 Samuel 7, 15 to 17, the promises to David, thy throne shall be established forever. In Isaiah 9, 7, Messiah would sit upon the throne of David. So that concept continues. Ezekiel 21, 25 to 27 shows a period of overturning, beginning with the dethronement of Zedekiah, ending at the second advent of Jesus. Now, Brother Russell ties this with the times of the Gentiles. And that expression, as you know, only occurs once in the scriptures. It occurs in Luke chapter 21, verse 24. Luke 21, 24, that Jerusalem shall be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, what does this say to us? What it says to me is that the times of the Gentiles is a period of time. The verse in Luke 21:24 does not say when the period begins, but it does give us circumstances that we can look for to know when it has ended. The ending of the period is not specifically given in Luke 21, but there are suggestions as to what we should expect. And Brother Russell draws from that and fills in it a little bit for us. It ends during the regathering of Israel back to Jerusalem. Now, that's a process which covers a long period of time. In some ways, it began in 1878. In other ways, there were important historical aspects which we would look at after 1914, and of course, culminating in 1948 when they became a nation again. To me, that's a very strong proof that the times of the Gentiles have ended. And if you say, well, they didn't get Jerusalem then, well, in 1967 they did. So to me, that's kind of the final proof. It ends while Jerusalem is being rebuilt by the Jews. And again, that's a process, that the Gentile times end. And if we see Jerusalem being rebuilt, that's an indication to us the times of the Gentiles have been fulfilled. If you look at various Bible commentators concerning this expression, trodden underfoot, you will find it has special significance. And Brother Russell was a good student. He did that. And most of the good Bible commentators, personally, I think are from the Philadelphia period of the church. I think they were spirit-begotten brethren, and I trust them. I don't trust a lot of the ones that are around after that. But that's personal decision. But there is some unanimity with Barnes, Gill, Schofield, Wesley, and some others. You can look it up. That this concept of trodden underfoot has the significance that we already detailed, that it has to do with them being regathered to Jerusalem and rebuilding it. Essentially, the point is they are reversing the destructive process of Jerusalem by the Gentiles that occurred earlier in AD 69 through 73, reversing that process of destruction. So, we find other places in the chronology, and we don't have time to go into that, that the beginning of the times of the Gentiles was with the captivity under Nebuchadnezzar and ended, I believe, in 1914. But that's not the main point. The main point here is we can look backwards and see whether or not Jerusalem is being trodden down and to determine whether that's true or not. I know there's arguments on both sides of that, but to me, it's very convincing that Jerusalem is no longer trodden down of the Gentiles. Okay, now we get into sealing in the foreheads. I believe it's a process. And Brother Russell suggested it has both a personal and a prophetic application. It's easy to see on the personal side, I think. We all recognize that it begins at the time of consecration in a particular sense, and it continues until we have that seal. And I'm using it in the sense that Brother Russell often uses it as intellectual appreciation of the truth, which occurs on this side of the veil. Now, there is a sense in which sealed is, like we say, signed, sealed, and delivered, and that's when somebody goes beyond the veil. And that's true, too. But that's not what we want to focus on in looking at this. I think there is a time when all of the church are beyond the veil and sealed in the final sense. But there are other places where Brother Russell uses this terminology to describe a process on this side of the veil. And unless we understand both of those, I think there can be confusion and seeming contradiction. But I don't think it's contradictory. The sealing of the foreheads in Revelation 7 is a prophetic picture. It doesn't apply to all the Lord's people during the whole gospel age. It's only to those at the end of the age. The holding back of the four winds relates to the time of trouble. The sealing intellectually is in the mind. It is more than a general understanding. It is an understanding of God's character and plan. And I would say it would involve the harvest message. I think anybody who's going to make their calling and election sure in the Laodicean period at some point or another has to hear the harvest message. Otherwise, I don't think they have enough to make it. Now, in this article, and we're still looking at question book 79 to 89, there's a discussion concerning Psalm 149, verse 5. And you remember that's the verse where it says the saints rejoice. How does it go? In the saints in glory and the ones in their beds. I'm sorry, I was going to write it down and I forgot. Who can quote that for me? But the rest of it. Okay, thank you. Rejoicing in glory, saints on the other side of the veil sing aloud upon their beds. I like the idea that that's on this side of the veil. And Brother Russell expands on that. On the other side of the veil, and he ties this in with sealing in the foreheads, okay? That may seem unusual. Read the article and you'll get a better understanding of it. But he says that it ties to the sealing in the foreheads, and that the saints, the sleeping saints, they had to be sealed in their foreheads. And that takes place on the other side in 1878 when they're raised. This is in this article in question book 79 to 89. But he repeats the concept also in the next one. Okay. And the saints are being sealed since 1878 on this side of the veil. We're talking about the intellectual sealing. Okay. To me, this was something I hadn't noticed before, that there's an intellectual sealing that occurs on the other side with those who had died prior to 1878. But that makes sense if you think about it. Somebody who died in the Dark Ages, what did they know about certain features of the plan of God? It's only understandable that they would get that at the point that they're resurrected. They got the perfect mind and they're brought up to date quickly. I like that. So, all living since 1878, they get sealed on this side of the veil. And that sealing includes an understanding of the time of trouble. We'll look at that more in a moment. And the scripture that's used is 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 to 4. But ye brethren are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief. And also, you'd look at 2 Peter, the entire third chapter, in context as additional thoughts along the same lines. Okay. So, I think there are logical connections that we can make between these various prophetic markers based on the foregoing, and it's my interpretation of what the foregoing says. But the time of trouble is a long process with many spasms. That the sealing on this side of the veil is accomplished by harvest truth. That the loosing of the four winds is a process that culminates in anarchy. And personally, I believe that this is a consistent and harmonious solution to the problem of time. You know, we all get this question asked, or we ask the question ourselves, what's been going on for the last 100 years? You know, we're coming up to that 100th anniversary of 1914. And we have to be able to think this through. What's the Lord been doing? Why is it so long? To me, it has to be a process that is shown in the plan of God. It all has to do with this time of trouble. Now, granted, we may use different terminology, and maybe some would shy away from tying in certain of the prophecies that we brought out here this morning. But there again, you know, go home and study it out. Now, we want to go to the next question book reference, which is question book 89 to 99, 11 pages. The main purpose of that response was to give a detailed explanation of the dispossession of Gentile powers as being a process which culminates in the complete loosing of the four winds. It begins with the process of loosing the four winds, and it ends with the complete loosing of the four winds. Brief quote. And he ties this in with the gathering of Jews from other places around the world where they had been dispersed. He says, what we do see is a sufficient number to fulfill God's word, a gathering of some of the most earnest Jews from all parts of the world. He's looking at that. At that time in 1914, and there were Jews who were coming back. But, you know, in other places, he says, we expect there to be a lot more. But it's a process. Now, he repeats all of the key points from the previous question book reference of Q79 to Q89, which we've already considered, so we won't repeat those, but he repeats them. He does. And he adds an explanation of parousia, epiphania, and apocalypse. This is an area where there's some differences of ideas, and, you know, it's not really clear every place you look at this in the writings of Brother Russell, but this is a later article in which he makes a more clear-cut distinction, and I appreciated that. Parousia is relatively easy. Period of presence. He identifies that as 1,000 years from 1874 to 2874. Then Epiphania, he says, is the manifestation of the kingdom from 1914 and onward. Now, the manifestation isn't understood by everyone, but it's there. You can see it. The world, mankind sees it. They just don't know what it is. Then you have Apocalypsis, which is the full revealment in flaming fire, taking vengeance, and eventually that does open the eyes of the people, and eventually they do recognize the presence of our Lord. So we want to look at Apocalypsis a little bit more. Here's a rather long quote, but it's important because it ties in some of the other points we've been talking about. When will it be? He says that will be after October 1914. Yes. How long will it take? I do not know. Have you any guess? Guesses are very dangerous things. And if I will do any guessing, I will give you the reason why I guess. In this case, we have seen the parallel in the ending of the Jewish age. The city was destroyed in AD 70. The ending of the gospel age and the baptism of trouble will come. The elements will melt with fervent heat. The capitalistic elements and all. The whole world will become like a furnace, every man's hand against his neighbor. That is the Bible description of it. The fire will come on the men in a natural way. It is their own fire that they built. I like that. That's interesting. I repeat that sentence. The fire will come on the men in a natural way. It is their own fire that they built. It is because they are not living up to their grant. Pause for a moment. What grant is he talking about? He's talking about the grant of Gentile powers, dominion, during the period of the times of the Gentiles. Continue on the quote. The Bible indicates that this condition would have come long ago if God had not held it back. When the right time comes, God will no longer hold the four winds back, and the conflagration will be thorough and swift and terrible. Now, that's the end of the quote, and there's different conclusions you might draw. But I try to see that in connection with the other references. When he says the conflagration will be thorough, swift, and terrible, he already told us that doesn't mean overnight. He shows us that it's a period, it's a process that corresponds to the vision, Elijah's vision of the time of trouble with the different phases. It's not instantaneous. He already prepared us to realize that this might take many years, even decades. He gives additional details concerning Psalm 149, verse 5, in this section as well. And you can look at that. But they are very similar to what we already mentioned. And here's a final quote from this section. He's talking about the parable of the pearl of great price. Sell everything you have to obtain this pearl. You sold out your own will once, and you have nothing to say whether God's plan is October 1914 or 1940. Now, again, you know, he's not saying that it's going to end in 1940. He's just setting some future date that was way beyond his lifetime. He's not telling us how long, but he wants us to realize that it could be a long time. So, in summary, what does this quotation mean? What it means to me is that the gathering of Jews to Israel relates to the end of Gentile times. I think we've seen that clearly in a number of ways. The time of trouble will manifest the kingdom, but it will still be unrecognized for what it is. It will be a manifestation, but they won't know what it is. The full revealment will be at the end of the time of trouble, the great time of trouble, the anarchy. The period between the beginning and ending of the time of trouble, it begins with the Epiphania, beginning 1914, encompasses a long period, perhaps decades, and ends with the Apocalypsis. Okay, we have another question book reference that we want to look at. And this is question book 737 from 1911. And it's here that he makes a connection between the four winds of Revelation 7 and the fallen angels again. And we are going to summarize. So again, you have to determine whether it's a correct summary or not. There's a distinction between the four winds and their loosing. There is a distinction between the four winds and their loosing. The four winds are one thing. The loosing of them is something else. The powers that hold them back is something else. The results of their being loosed is something else. But the point here is that the four winds are the fallen angels, the powers of the air. The loosing of the four winds is a process. It encompasses the complete time of trouble, such as never was. It includes the strife, war, trouble, and confusion of that time of trouble. And the final result is anarchy. So, keep in mind, I understand why we would use this expression, but it's not exactly correct. The four winds are not anarchy. It is the result of loosing the four winds that brings anarchy, a subtle distinction. And the scriptures mention that the loosing of the fallen angels occurs during the judgment of the great day. And you know those two scriptures from 2 Peter 2:4 and Jude 1:6. Reprint 4879 is from 1911 also, the judgment of the angels. And he suggests that it was in the near future and perhaps had already begun to some extent. But he outlines there what he believed would constitute their judgment. That it would be necessary for them to have a full opportunity, liberty, to either continue sinning or to repent. And that this liberty, this judgment, could only be accomplished by their loosing. Two quotes. At the time of the judgment of the great day, we may expect the bonds restraining these spirits to be loosened. Second, these powers of the air that are being held until the saints of God shall have been sealed in their foreheads are these fallen angels. End of quotation. Well, here's where we get a lot of different thoughts. And I understand that. And I don't have a simple, easy explanation other than what we've already stated, that I think the sealing in the foreheads that he's speaking of here is the intellectual appreciation. And at the time that the loosing of the fallen angels began, a full opportunity had been granted to all of the spirit begotten to have the intellectual appreciation of the truth. And that has continued on an individual basis since that time. Reprint 5058 from 1912, 5058. A Legion of Demons, a Prophetic Lesson. And this is another one I had not seen before, and it was quite intriguing to me. He's drawing a lesson from Mark 4:37, which continues on to 5:13. Mark 4:37 to 5:13, and the parallel is in Luke 8:22 to 33. This is where you had the man who was possessed by a legion of demons, you remember? And it says, Jesus gave them leave. And Brother Russell draws a prophetic lesson. I hadn't thought of that before. I just thought, well, it's interesting, but I hadn't thought of it as a prophetic lesson. Here's what he says. Jesus has control over the powers of the air, the fallen angels. Well, that was obviously the case in this instance, in a literal sense. But notice that Jesus did not merely cast them out of the man. It's peculiar. I've often thought of that. Why did he let them go into the pigs? And why did they want to go into the pigs? He gave them liberty. And what was the result of that liberty? It was chaos, violence, and destruction. And the suggestion here is that those swine could represent the Gentile systems. Now, the man who was possessed could represent the world of mankind. He wasn't destroyed. He was enlightened. It would parallel Nebuchadnezzar's 7 years of madness, and afterwards his reason returned to him. And it's another tie-in to the 2,520 years of the Gentile times. He says that at the point where this occurs, that the systems are no longer authorized and are gradually destroyed, but not instantly. They have one last mad rampage leading to their destruction, shown by the pigs being possessed and going towards the sea. And, of course, the sea represents the masses, which eventually overthrow them, swallowed up by the sea. And he ties this in with, as in the days of Noah. And in a very interesting fashion, he says, as in the days of Noah. Well, the fallen angels had liberty then also. He makes that parallel. The result was giants in those days. And we see giants in these days. And the results were so terrible that that order had to be destroyed. And we know that that's true at this end of this age also. Being cast into the sea would correspond to Psalm 46, verse 2, and some other references. So, what's the conclusion? That the time of trouble is the result of the loosing of the four winds. Not merely the climax, not merely the anarchy, but the entire four phases of the time of trouble, beginning with war. It's a process. It's a period of time. The swinish systems will create havoc under the fallen angels' influence. And the end result is anarchy and the complete destruction of this order. To me, that's a reasonable explanation for what's been going on for the past 100 years, and especially now, because I believe, and there is another article where I think Brother Benjamin Barton suggests the concept, where it is a proportion that as Satan is being bound, which we saw that Volume 1 reference earlier that mentions that concept, as Satan is being bound, in proportion as he is being bound, the fallen angels are gaining greater liberty. That makes sense to me. Reprint 5317. This one is from 1913. And it's the final subheading, Signs of Dispensational Change. Two brief quotes. All of these things together will constitute the time of trouble. That's the first quote. And he says this is social upheaval, political troubles, financial troubles. Repetition of points we've seen before. The second one, he says this will occur when the four winds, the fallen angels, will become loose. But again, the point being that their loosing is a process which begins at the beginning of the time of trouble. Reprint 5469. 5469 is from June 1914. Loosing the four winds. And the theme text is Daniel 12:1. And he first points out that it's the most severe, the greatest time of trouble, because it is the most intense. It is the most widely diffused. It is the most general. And due to the gathering of people in cities with high standards of living. I thought that's an interesting expression. He had tremendous foresight, didn't he? Due to gathering of people in cities with high standards of living. You know, you'd think that if you had high standard of living, that you'd be satisfied. But that's not what happens. It leads to greater dissatisfaction. And then there is a subtitle, The Four Great Winds. And there he repeats this concept, that the four great winds are the fallen angels, the powers of the air, no longer under Satan's control. They are being granted liberty by God. And there's another subtitle, same article, Fallen Angels Soon to be Loosed. This is June 1914. So he was looking forward to that as happening. And later on we'll see that he believed that it started to happen in October 1914. He draws a parallel again to Luke 17, 26 to 30, as in the days of Noah, which we discussed briefly already. Great crime and angry passion would be the result. Okay, let's move after 1914. I think that's important in order to see whether he had this extra time to think about it, and we passed that benchmark. Do we still see the same things the same way? In 5752, reprint 5752, which is August of 1915, Elijah's Flight and Vision. You're probably familiar with that article. And he says that the kingdom administration begins while the church is still in the flesh, in fact, since 1878 in a special way. And during that time, the Elijah class receives a vision of the time of trouble. Prior to that time, Elijah was discouraged as a class. They didn't understand what was going on. And one of the reasons God gives Elijah this vision, he explains it, and of course we have the further, fuller explanation, was to encourage him. That vision gives an explanation of the time of trouble and the glorious eventual results. And in this article, it brings out how the permission of evil is a key to this correct understanding, and that the kingdom is inaugurated in a time of trouble. And then he goes on to say, this is after October 1914, that the four phases of Elijah's vision began with the outbreak of World War I. This thought is elaborated upon. It is repeated, showing the war, the social revolution, the anarchy, and eventually, well, the still small voice, but here he borrows from Luther's translation, the voice of Eden. I always like that expression. The voice of Eden was the voice that Adam heard in the garden, the voice of God. And he says, the fulfillment of the vision has begun, Elijah's vision of 1 Kings 19:11-12. And he says, quote, the present European war is letting loose of the four winds of heaven, end of quote. Now, if we understand from his previous references to this and to subsequent references, he's talking about the fallen angels, that the loosing began in October of 1914, and that the war was an evidence of that because it was the first phase of the time of trouble. He says, the living members of the Elijah class have the intellectual ceiling. And that certainly was possible, because, you know, Brother Russell's ministry was worldwide at that time, and there was ample opportunity for all of the Lord's consecrated people to come to an understanding of the truth. He then says that not all parts of the vision, Elijah's vision of the four phases, will be completed when Elijah is taken. There is another article in reprint 5764, it's four pages, and in the middle and the end of that article, he presents a similar thought, if you want another reference. Reprint 5770. This is from September 1915. And in particular on reprint 5771, section, the present war result of selfishness. Present war result of selfishness. And he says, the four winds were let loose in the great war, and the additional phases of the time of trouble will follow. And here again, the thought being that it was the fallen angels who began to be loosed at that time. March 1916, reprint 5863, reprint 5863, the second epistle of St. Peter. And here he ties together a number of different symbols. We have fire indicated in many places. This is referring to the climax of the time of trouble, a great tidal wave in Psalm 46, and the loosing of the four winds in Revelation 7:1-3, which eventually culminate in anarchy. And here, again, he points out that there are phases to the time of trouble, that it begins with the war and ends with the anarchy, that the ecclesiastical systems will be destroyed first, and that the social and financial systems would follow. And, of course, we know that that's the way it's portrayed in Revelation 18 and other places. And he says, quote, the long foretold time of trouble has begun. So what's the point? I see a consistency in what he presents, that he began prior to 1914, some years prior to that, to see that the time wasn't going to be long enough and that it was going to take more than just a year to fulfill all of the things that are indicated in the prophecies, that it would be the entire period of the time of trouble. And then he indicates consistently before 1914, during and after, that the fallen angels were gradually being released since 1914. That the end, here's the practical application for us. Because, you know, none of this means anything if it doesn't affect us in our consecrated life. And that's really the bottom line. That's really the end result that's most important. How do we apply this personally? What difference does it make if we believe one thing or another? Now, I'm not saying that if you don't believe what I've just presented that you're not going to be able to make it. No, that's not the point. We would just probably accomplish the same things in different ways. But to me, this is a help because I see what's happened since 1914. And to me, it's a proof of what Brother Russell has stated in these articles and elsewhere. And to me, that gives me encouragement to believe that his expectations concerning the future are also correct. So, the unrepentant fallen angels, what are they going to want to do first? They're going to want to go after you and me. That's a scary thought. We should not be surprised by increased activities in this area. I'm summarizing the thoughts of this article, but it's important for us to take this to heart. We should be alert but not afraid. You know, I remember when I first got the truth, and I think maybe because of my Catholic background and having studied with the witnesses for a year and a half, I had a real fear and dread of the fallen angels. I thought, you know, it's like the boogeyman, they're going to come and get me. And the Lord gave me some experiences where I knew they were real. I know the fallen angels exist, you know. I not only believe there's God, I believe there's a Satan. And I believe that there's holy angels and there's unholy angels. But we don't have to be afraid because the Lord is protecting us. The Lord may permit certain tests. That's true. And we have to be aware of that. And if they are being granted liberty, which I believe they are, we need to be aware of that. To be forewarned is to be forearmed and to take the necessary precautions. We must always remember that though the Lord will permit certain tests, he will never permit it to be more than we can bear. You remember that was the incident with Elisha and his servant. I forget what his name was. And he was frightened because it looked like they were just really outnumbered. And God let the eyes of his servant to be opened. And he saw all those myriads of spirit beings around them which were protecting them. Well, we don't see that with our natural eyes, but we know it's true. So we don't ever want to forget that. But we do need to be aware of the methods that the fallen angels will be permitted to use. Primarily, it will be personal attacks. And I think one of the primary ways that they do this, and I know this from experience of my own and of others, they sow thoughts designed to convince us to give up. They're trying to kill the new creature. Let's remember that. Let's keep in mind where these thoughts are coming from. This isn't coming from God. He would never tell us to give up. Jesus would never tell us to give up. We'd never tell each other to give up. If you get that thought, you know it's coming from the adversary and from the fallen angels. And I think more so from the fallen angels right now. Don't believe it. They also will try, like a wolf tries, to get one of the sheep to get away from the fold, to become an isolationist. We don't want to do that. You know, why does the Apostle Paul put such emphasis in Hebrews 10, 24 and 25 the way he does? Forsake not the assembling of yourselves together, and so much the more so, we'd add Ephesians 6 in there, as you see the day drawing on. We're in that evil day. We need the whole armor of God. We need to be aware of the tactics of the fallen angels, and that they're going to try to get to us. And if they can't get to us personally, they'll try in other ways. They might try to attack us through family, through friends, through loved ones. They fight dirty. They don't abide by the rules. Don't be surprised by anything. Don't be shocked. But never, never give up, because the Lord is on our side. And greater is he that is for us than all they that be against us. Even though we fight not merely against flesh and blood, as difficult as that battle is, you know, that's tough. Not merely against flesh and blood, but against wicked spirits in high places. So what should we do? Well, there's a lot of scriptures I'm sure that would come to your mind, and you can add your own. when the world sees these things, their hearts fail them for fear. We see the same things and we lift up our heads and we rejoice. Because we like those things? No. They're horrible. But because we recognize they're signs of where we are, how close we are to the end, and our deliverance draweth nigh. These are wonderful promises that are given to us. And I think that we can see all around us, regardless of how you might view the specifics and how I put together prophetic picture, and if you disagree with me, that's fine. But I hope that we all see what's happening in the earth today, and these are indications to us. We're pretty far along, and we're getting very close to the end, and we need to have courage. Gird up the loins of our minds. Don't give up. Keep trying, and the Lord will be with us. May the Lord help us to that end. Amen.
Thank you, Brother Allen. What a lesson. I think the tape sales are going to go up on this. The process, the expectations, the changes and shifts in time, the influence of the fallen angels that results in the releasing of the four winds. I think the subtle point that I particularly enjoy is that hours of Brother Allen's study have just been presented to us in 60 minutes, and we get the gleanings. Thank you.